Still have enough time. Do I sit down even now?
We don't know how many times I can tell you have like
Welcome. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's Pacific Institute for Mathematical Sciences distinguished lecturer Avi Victorson. Since receiving his PhD from Princeton University in 1983, Avi has worked in virtually all areas of theoretical science, especially complexity theory, lower bounds, and applications of randomness to distributed computing, algorithms, interactive proofs, and cryptography. For these 10,
British Columbia, this is the University of Alberta. We're not getting any sound.
This is SFU, all we heard was U of A.
Good. We're not getting any sound at all at the University of Alberta.
Sorry, apparently the...
Until now.
From the top?
But let's make sure that...
Okay, we heard that from the top.
Are you going to do the same to me in the middle of the night?
It's my pleasure to announce and introduce Avi Victorson as today's distinguished lecturer in the Pacific Institute for Mathematical Sciences. Since receiving his PhD from Princeton University in 1983, Avi has worked in virtually all areas of theoretical computer science, especially complexity theory and lower bounds, randomization and its applications to distributed computing, algorithms, interactive proofs, and cryptography. For these and his other accomplishments, he received the Nevin Linna Prize at the International Congress for Mathematicians in Zurich in 1994. He's currently the holder of the Marcy Bergen Chair for Academic Excellence at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel. He'll be speaking to us today on computational pseudorandomness. Avi.
Thanks. Okay. Hi, everyone. It's the first time I'm speaking sitting down. It's very weird for me. It's also the first time I'm speaking with so many gadgets around. It's not clear why you fly 24 hours to come to a place where they broadcast your... But anyway, that's the situation. So what I want to tell you today is about this this area that I... like a lot, that developed within theoretical computer science in the last 20 years or so. The main issue we are talking about here is randomness, which is a subject that has been under human investigation for centuries. And I think that the point of view, the complexity theoretic point of view, threw a totally different light on it and brought all sorts of understandings of this notion that go beyond computer science. And I will not talk about this. I will not talk about philosophy here. I'll just talk about concrete complexity theory and this notion of pseudo randomness and exactly what it is and what we do with it. And in this sequence, in this 20 years, we have reached an understanding that's quite non-trivial. I'll try to tell you exactly what is this understanding and what were the key ideas that led to it, I think that you can do this in the span of 1 hour, at least get the essential ideas across, and that's what I'll try to do. I think that it's, I mean, again, it's the first time I'm doing this kind of talk with these videos, but I think that it's okay if you ask me questions, and maybe they'll point the camera to you a little bit. Okay, good. So, the first thing is just to see what exactly is this point of view of complexity theory on randomness, and this kind of story that I'm going to tell you, I'm not sure who made it up, maybe Silvio Micali, but anyway, it's something that people use a lot to explain this, how we think of randomness, and more or less you should think that we are playing a game where I take out a coin and I hold it in my hand and I'm playing the game with you, for example. I'm going to flip it. We can assume that it's a perfectly unbiased coin and that the force I'm going to apply to it is totally random. And now you have to guess whether it comes out heads or tails. And, you know, what would be your chances of guessing? 50-50. I think everybody would more or less agree to that. And now we can start changing the rules of the game a little bit. And let's say, suppose, you know, you have to guess while the coin is in the air. Will it change the chances? Probably not. Suppose I let you hold other people with laptops here. Suppose you have a laptop in your lap. I mean, would it change, make a difference? Yeah, you're allowed to hold a laptop and play with it. Probably not. And, well, here I don't have to add that there are video cameras around. So there are video cameras around. Does it help? Well, I mean, when you take it sufficiently far to extreme, you can imagine that these video cameras are focused on my fingers and they are connected to an extremely powerful cray or something that can, I don't know, in a second, suddenly, and probably much faster, determine from the first few spins of the coin exactly the momentum and, you know, everything you need to know while it's in the air, exactly what it will land with. So the bottom line of this story is that you know, whether this coin flip is random depends on your computational power. So the point of view complexity theory takes on randomness is that it is a very pragmatic point of view. So random is something that you cannot discern from random with so many, you know, cycles or so much computational power. So I'm not sure exactly what is the background of people here and of the audience in general, but I mean, if we are talking about, if we are taking this point of view of complexity, I have to tell you some about complexity and to sort of tell you the language I'm going to use, and well, this is really going to be a problem here. That's the complexity world. Here it goes. So complexity theory deals with computational problems. We have lots of natural computational problems around that we are trying to solve. Everybody does in academia, in companies, and all, you know, at home. And what complexity theory and theory of algorithms are trying to do is to classify these computational problems according to how difficult they are, you know, how much time and other resources they require when we are trying to solve them. And we try to group these problems together in equivalence classes, more or less, of, you know, of what we call complexity classes. Some of them you must have heard of, like P and NP, but I'll define them in a second. And others maybe you didn't hear of. And you find here all sorts of problems. Many of them you know, sorting, determinant, factoring integers, satisfiability, etc. And the situation is that that's what we are trying to do, but we are far from understanding this world at all. So let me try to get into the definitions of these notions, because these complexity classes, because I'll talk about them here. So here's just a few examples of computational problems and what we know of their complexity. So, and actually I'll try to present both problems that we know are easy and problems we don't know what their status is, and actually sometimes they look awfully similar. So for example, so always our problems are finite problems, their input, you know, the data is finite. And for example, one problem is we get a pair of integers, x and m, and we want to compute one of the following functions, either square x modulo m, that's one function, or take the square root, which is the inverse of this modulo m. And, you know, for squaring, it's very easy to do. It's certainly at most quadratic time, where n here denotes the length of this integer. This will be given, say, in binary notation. And so there are very efficient algorithms for squaring a number modulo another number, but if you want to do just the opposite and take the square root, that I'm sure some people here know is equivalent to factoring the integer m, and that nobody has any good idea how to do efficiently. The best algorithm would be exponential in square root of n, so it should be hopeless to factor 1,000-digit integers with today's algorithm. That doesn't mean that we know that this is the best running time. It just means that we have no better algorithm yet. Okay, and they are similar. I mean, these are just examples. So here are here's another type of problem. You are given a graph, let's say a network of roads or something like this, and you want the shortest path from some city S to some other city T. If you want to compute the shortest path, then there is a very fast algorithm, nearly linear time. Another problem that sounds like it's twin, you know, is computing the longest path between those two nodes. And again, I mean, this problem, the best bound we know for it is best upper bound is exponential in n, so it's hopeless to really try to do it. We don't know that that's the best algorithm, but we do know about this problem that it's NP complete, and that means, I'm not going to define it, but it roughly means that it's even more hopeless to do than this one, because if you could do that one, you would be solving lots of other problems efficiently. And here's the last example, this favorite matrix problem, maybe more familiar to mathematicians. You are given a matrix, let's say n by n matrix, and you want to compute the determinant. Determinant is very easy because we have Gaussian elimination at our disposal, the m-cubed algorithm. And if you want to rather compute the permanent of the matrix, which is the same as determinant, only looks simpler because it doesn't have all these signs around, then turns out that it's an extremely hard function. It's, in fact, in some very precise sense, even harder than that one, this longest path one. And again, the best algorithm we have is exponential in n. So I wanted to show you this dichotomy just to say that in all these problems, there are trivial exponential time algorithms, where exponential means exponential in n to the constant. And we consider exponential extremely inefficient. I mean, for reasonable size instances, we have no chance of finishing anything. And what we do call efficient is the class P, polynomial time. These are problems that can be solved in time, something like n to the constant, where the input size is n. Okay, so here you see lots of natural problems, and some of them are easy, and others are, you know, we don't know. And in fact, that leads me to I'm going to talk about two major problems of our field of theoretical computer science. And the first problem is, are there natural hard problems? So, are there any problems at all that we find natural, like I'm sure you find the problems I showed you, the longest path, permanent, etc. Are they really hard, or it's just our ignorance that stops us from, you know, finding efficient algorithms for it? And this, you know, you can specify this in lots of ways. You have to say what you call natural, and you have to say what you call hard. So one thing I'll talk about later, you can ask whether there are one-way functions, like problems like factoring or square root. Some problems, well, I'll define it later. You can ask the P versus NP problem. Are the, you know, is the class NP the class of, you know, problems that contain this longest path example? or satisfiability, or, you know, the traveling salesman problem. Are they all easy? Are they all equal to P, or not? And that's another, that's probably the most important manifestation of the question, are there natural heart problems? And you can go even farther in your notion of natural, all the way to exponential, to the class of exponential time functions. And there it's not, it doesn't make too much sense to ask whether exponential time equals P, because we know the answer is no. There is a hierarchy theorem for time, the amount of time you invest. But anyway, you can ask an almost identical question for which we don't know the answer. Can every problem in exponential time, like all the ones I discussed, be solved by polynomial size hardware, by polynomial size Boolean circuits? Okay, that's totally open. So all these questions, which are the most important questions of the, you know, so these manifestations of this question are totally open, and we have no idea how to even address them at this point. So that's one class of problems. The second problem I want to talk about concerns randomness. I mean, what I really came here to talk about. And again, I just to put everybody on common grounds, I want to sort of give you a definition, an example and a definition of probabilistic algorithms. So, how many people saw a probabilistic algorithm? Maybe for primality testing? Yeah, a few. Okay, good. So it's good. Tell me if I'm going too fast. Here's the idea. So let me give you the following example. So something that would be awfully useful to do is the following. Suppose you are given some polynomial P, a real, let's say, or, you know, rational or integer coefficient, in many variables, x1 through xn, and of some bounded degree. I mean, not necessarily bounded, given degree, D. And what you want to know is whether this polynomial is identically zero. Okay? Let me, in fact, first give a few reasons why you would like to do that. I mean, if you could do that, you could verify all sorts of important identities. I mean, so, you know, the binomial identity of Newton is exactly the statement that this particular polynomial written here is identically zero, right? Of course, he proved it, and the proof is simple, and you don't need any other way to check it. And similarly, van der Monde's identity about the determinant of so-called van der Monde matrix is another such statement. It says that a particular polynomial in many variables is identically zero. But suppose I invented a new identity and came to you, and I claim it's an identity. How would you test? You know, how would you test? It turns out that algorithms of the type we described, and maybe you are more used to, the deterministic algorithms, those that are typically implemented anywhere, deterministic algorithms, the best way to do that is still D to the N. Requires D to the N time. So if N is large, the number of variables, it's hopeless. I mean, you wouldn't be able to test me if my identity was an identity or not. But there is a very simple way to do it, probabilistically, in nearly linear time and the steps. And the idea is simple, and I'll show it to you, but just before I show it to you, you should think, I mean, it should be obvious, I think, to most mathematicians that, to all mathematicians. If this polynomial is identically zero, then, it's not identically zero, then its zero set is some lower dimensional manifold. So if you just sort of take a random point and try to evaluate this polynomial, you land outside this variety. So that's exactly what happens. Turns out that you can even be a little clever and make it discrete. You don't have to pick a random point in the real space. In fact, it's sufficient that you pick a random point, so you have n coordinates, r1 through rn, and every entry here, ri, is sufficient that it will be just an integer between, let's say, 1 and 3d, d being the degree of the polynomial. And if you do that, then, so you pick it randomly, and then if it's 0, you evaluate the polynomial on this at this point. You see that for this, you don't need the polynomial being written explicitly. Some of the polynomials I showed you here, if you wrote them explicitly, would have exponential length. But these two you can actually describe very simply, let's say, by, I mean, we know how to compute the determinant, so you can give a program for the determinant. So all you need is to evaluate this polynomial in that random point, and, you know, if it's zero, you say it's identically zero. If not, then you say no. And this kind of algorithm, first of all, it uses randomness to pick the random point. That's one feature. The other feature, which is not so good, is that it makes errors. You know, so I just said what it does, but it actually doesn't always answer correctly, right? We can check exactly what happens. Of course, if the polynomial is identically zero, every point you'll plug will come out zero, and then you'll never make an error. But if the polynomial was not identically zero, you can calculate, it's a simple calculation. I mean, you can easily see it in the case of one variable. We know the polynomial has at most D roots, so if you plug 3D values uniformly chosen, the error probability is at most a third. The probability of landing at a root is at most a third, and turns out this carries over to any number of variables. So this algorithm is a probabilistic algorithm, and its error probability is one third. Okay? And that's exactly the kind of algorithms that we'll be interested in, actually, in understanding the power of these algorithms. But let me just define this class. We had P was the class of deterministic polynomial time algorithms. RP is the analog randomized polynomial time, is the analog class where you allow your algorithms to be probabilistic. So you are allowed to run in polynomial time and to some constant, and you are allowed to make an error which is, let's say, at most one third on any instance. It's this one third is totally arbitrary, and it's very easy to see that if you can achieve one third, and then you can actually decrease it by repeating many times, you can decrease the error as much as you like. You can make it exponentially small. So you can almost eliminate the error, but not quite. So this class of algorithms certainly is stronger than the class of deterministic algorithms, so RP contains P. And on the other hand, there is a trivial, you know, de-randomization of such algorithms. Go through all possible values of your coin tosses, right? The algorithm ran in polynomial time, so it flipped at most polynomially many coins. Try all possibilities, it's just 2 to the polynomial, that's just exponential time. So RP lives between P and exponential time. We don't quite know which. And the interesting thing is that this example I showed you, and maybe primality testing that other people know about, are not the only examples. Turns out that there are, well, of course, random algorithms existed much before theoretical computer science, in physics and statistics and so on. But anyway, within theoretical computer science, people developed since the 70s more and more sophisticated probabilistic algorithms for a host of problems in various sort of application areas. And for none of them is there any, you know, nobody has any idea how to do them deterministically. Okay, so all these problems are in RP. They are not known to be in P, and almost all are not even known to be in sub-exponential time. Namely, there is nobody has an idea of how to even save one random bit in a probabilistic algorithm, in a generic probabilistic algorithm, without doubling the time. So asking the question whether you can have a deterministic algorithm that is doing something non-trivial, you know, maybe just running in sub-exponential time. Sub-exponential, I mean, something like 2 to the n to the epsilon. You know, for essentially none of them do we know even this. The only simulations, deterministic simulations we have are trivial. Okay, so this leads me to the second major problem of theoretical computer science, which is, I forgot to tell you the answer to the first question. So I asked, the first question was, what I asked at least, are there any natural hard problems? And I should have said that, you know, at least we have plenty of examples for which we have no idea how to do efficiently. So the empirical answer, at least so far, is yes, and I'm sure that if you force any computer scientist to make a bet, that's what he'll say. He'll say that P is different than P. The second question is, again, motivated by the same host of examples we have of lots of things we can do efficiently if we have coin tosses, but we don't know how to without coin tosses, is does randomness help for computation? Does it enhance computation? And again, you can have various forms, like you had various forms before of this question, concrete forms. Is it true that RP equals P, or is it different? So are there problems here which are not here? Or can you simulate everything in RP deterministically in sub-exponential time, or something non-trivial? And the empirical answer, at least so far, has to be the same, simply for the reason that we have all these examples, and we cannot de-randomize them. We cannot get rid of the randomness. And I'm not sure whether people are as certain at this as they are at this, but the main point of this lecture will be that those two answers are incompatible. Okay. So certainly there are concrete ways to formalize this informal theorem, saying that if there are natural hard problems, then randomness does not help. That's a theorem. Here are three concrete manifestations of them, and I'll show you some of them today, and maybe some tomorrow. So what do they say? Let's look at the first one. It says that, so it refers to the last type of formalization of natural hard problems in exponential time that have no polynomial size hardware or circuits. If any problem whatsoever is hard, the permanent or satisfiability or this any of these cannot be done in polynomial size, then immediately you get sub-exponential simulations of randomized algorithms. So randomness is not all that powerful. And if this is not strong enough for you, if this is not saying for you that randomness does not help, you can try the second version here, which is a result from last year of Russell and Pagliazzo and myself, saying that under somewhat stronger assumption that exponential time, does not have sub-exponential circuits, then RP equals P. So under this, under an assumption on the fact that some natural problems are difficult, what you get is that every probabilistic algorithm from this set of things I mentioned, each and every one of them can be done almost as well without tossing any random coins. Okay. And this thing is for people that are really picky and they don't like circuits. They want to see uniform assumptions, as they are called. I'll just mention it, even though I won't get to it even tomorrow. It's sort of a gap theorem. It says that this class of RP, of things can be done efficiently in polynomial time, either it is everything it can be, namely exponential time, or if not, then it's deeply inside exponential, it can be simulated in sub-exponential time. So, but anyway, I won't get to this. So, what I'm going to do from now on, this was sort of an introduction, was to sort of lead you through the ideas that, if you look at these two problems, one is are there hard problems, and the other does randomness help? It seems like they are totally unrelated. And this says not only are they very related, they are almost equivalent. The one and the complement of the other are almost equivalent. So what goes on? Where does it come from? And the main connection is already on this slide. This slide where I'll tell you about pseudo-randomness. So here's the connection. So first, let's just see what is the probabilistic algorithm in general. I told you what it was. Maybe it's an algorithm for some language or for some decision problem. You are given an X and you want to know whether the answer is yes or no, whether it's in this set L or not. So you have a polynomial time algorithm which is fed X, the input, and also a string of random bits, let's say N of them, the string R. And R is chosen uniformly at random. Okay, so U sub N will denote N random bits, uniform distribution on N bits. And this algorithm has a property, because it makes error at most one-third, that if, you know, X is in the language, should get a yes answer, we accept it with probability at least two-thirds, and otherwise we accept with probability at most one-third. So in other words, makes one-third error. And we have this this creature, and it is using random bits, and we want to eliminate them. Or maybe instead of eliminating them, at least use as few of them as possible. Okay? That's our task. And the key idea, which is, of course, not new, is to use what's called a pseudo-random generator. And the pseudo-random generator is the following thing. It's a deterministic function, G, capital G, that takes a seed. A seed is random bits, but much fewer random bits, S, and computes from these few random bits, S, many random bits, R. Okay? And that's the function. Okay, and we call G a generator. Any function that takes M bits to N bits, where N is bigger than M, that's what we call a generator. And what, of course, we are interested is, when is this generator good? Okay? And good is the same, has the same meaning as I gave you in the story with the coin flip. Good means that this algorithm is not going to behave differently whether it got truly random bits and random bits, or it got the output of this generator. Then it's good. So here's the definition of good. Good or pseudo-random. Oops. I'm forgetting that. Yeah, maybe I don't need this. So here is good. If for every for every algorithm A and for every input to this algorithm X, what this algorithm would do on the uniform distribution, or what it would do on this pseudo-random distribution D, which is the generator applied to a random seed, if this different. So what I mean here, let's say, is the probability that this algorithm says one, says yes. In those two situations, is at most one-third, one, let's say, tenth, then suddenly it can distinguish these two cases, two-thirds and one-third, right? Okay. So then we say it's good. And suppose you had a pseudo-random generator, a good generator G, what would you do? How would you de-randomize this algorithm? Well, it's sort of clear. I mean, right, you'll just try. You know, if you now don't have any coin flips, you'll just try all possible values for the seed S. There are 2 to the m of them. So that would be one cost in your deterministic simulation. 2 to the m. And the other thing, of course, you have to compute G, okay, each time. So this means that what we want is to have m, of course, as small as possible, the length of the seed, because we are going to pay 2 to the m in this deterministic simulation. And we want G to be a simple function as possible, right? Because then it's not going to cost us much when we are doing that. And the parameters that I'll use mostly in this talk and we'll be able to achieve is to pick m to be something like n to the delta, some n to the very tiny constant, 1,000th or 1,000,000th, whatever. And what will result from this choice, for example, in the simulation is that RP, every probabilistic algorithm, we will be able to simulate in sub-exponential time. So that's really a great plan, a very, nice plan. We just build a pseudo-random generator and do this de-randomization, and the main question is, where do we get this pseudo-random generator from? Right, that's... And... I'll point out already here that in some sense it has to involve hard functions. We are going to get it from natural hard functions, but already here you should see that it should involve some computationally hard function. So we said we wanted G to be easy because we are computing it as part of the simulation, but it should also be hard in some sense, right? In the following sense. Think of the computational problem. I give you a string of length n, and you are supposed to tell me whether it's in the image of G, whether it can be generated by G. It's a computational problem. If this problem was easy, you can throw away your generator. I mean, it's no good because, I mean, if you could efficiently do that, right? Because then that would be an algorithm that would distinguish random from pseudo-random distribution. So G has to be hard in some sense, but it's not the hardness I was talking about before. It's not the hardness of the permanent or factoring or so on. So from now on, we'll try somehow to convert the hardness we are used to talking about into the hardness that the generator needs. And before I go into this, let me just sort of tell you about some, you know, just give examples of generators. Of course, generators are not a new concept. At least unprovably, I mean, as objects that you just use in practice, they existed at least, 50 or more years since the, Los Alamos project or even before. Physicists use them all the time. And there are some examples. In fact, this one, the linear congruential generator, probably still exists on most of your, university software. Okay, so what is it? I want to give you some examples. So what is this generator? These generators I'll show you in the next couple of slides will all be iterative. They'll just repeat the application of a fixed function. And in this one, you pick a bunch of parameters, a prime p, two numbers n, b modulo p, and some start value r1. All of length, let's say m, these are the m bits, more or less the seed length. And you generate from this seed, this generator G generates a sequence of blocks of length m, r1, r2, etc., iteratively by ri plus 1 is simply applying this linear function, ari plus b mod p, to the previous block. Okay? So it takes the last block, you apply this linear transformation and get another block. I should point out that this, we'll do it, we'll generate n blocks. N is, we are thinking of m as being some small, tiny power of n, but still polynomial. So we are not going to get into periods and stuff like this. That's not the problem. Anyway, so everybody is using this generator. Is it good? I mean, is it pseudo-random in the sense that I told you in the previous slide? What do you think? Nobody wants to guess. I mean, everybody is using it. So what do you think? Is it good or bad? Well, it's pretty bad in the sense I described. I'm not going to show it here, but it's actually pretty bad. Von Neumann already in the early 50s, didn't like the linear, said linear functions are too easy. In fact, he was right. And he suggested to use something else. His generator was based on iterating another function, let's say little g here, the following function. You take an m-bit string, s, you square it, so when you square it as an integer, you get something of length about twice as long, and then take the middle s bits. This is g of s. So it's a well-defined function, little g, and then your generator, his generator, just iterates this one. Okay, so you just take g of s, g of s, etc. So again, you have you're generating some number of blocks, each of length m. Okay, is this generator good? It's certainly better than the previous one. It's probably good, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that anybody knows the proof. But around 19... Oops, what is it? And you are getting into trouble here. 1980, Adi Shamir had the following idea. He wanted to define goodness in a way that actually came up not from this motivation I told you about, but from cryptography. People were starting to play with cryptographic protocols, and in these protocols there were lots of randomness. People were generating primes at random and all sorts of secret messages at random and so on. And, he thought that, if I'm your adversary and you're generating things at random, but I can predict your generator. I know from what I've seen, in the last 10 steps of, our communication, I can know what you'll generate from now on. That's pretty bad for you. Okay? So we want to avoid this. And thinking more sort of globally, obviously if a generator is pseudo-random, it should not be predictable. If it is predictable, we can distinguish it from random. So he suggested looking at prediction tests for generators, which are the following. So suppose you have a generator generating blocks as before, and That's called PSP sub I, the probability, when we start from a random seed, that any efficient procedure T, and let's say polynomial time algorithm T, that would look at the first I blocks, will guess the I plus first block of this generator. And we said that G passes this test, this statistical test. It's the same notion of statistical test used in statistics. G, the generator, passes this test if the probability of a good guess, of a correct guess, is negligible. Well, it's close to random, or maybe it's just negligible. You know, you cannot get any chance of guessing it correctly. And then you call it, he called it cryptographically secure because of the application to cryptography. We call it this if it passes every efficient test. Okay, so you see here that the notion of test, like before, we quantified over all algorithms. Also here, this is quantifying over all efficient algorithms. But we look only at tests that are trying to predict the next block. Okay, so that's prediction tests. And the nice thing is that not only did it suggest this this notion of predictability test, but he actually provided generators that are good in this sense, that pass all prediction tests. And to tell you about them, I have to tell you first about one-way functions, because he had to build them from hard functions. Okay? And for those who have never seen this before, that's the most important concept in cryptography today, in public key cryptography. The notion of a one-way function, it's a function, let's call it little g here, was defined by Diffie and Hellman in 78. This paper is the foundation of modern cryptography. A function g is one way if, you know, given x, to compute g of x is hard. It's harder on average. At least every algorithm attempting to do that has a tiny probability of succeeding. But going backwards, given g of x, let's say it's 1 to 1. Given g of x and computing x is easy. It's in polynomial time. Okay? And here's an example of such a function. In fact, the example I also showed you in the first slide with squaring and taking square roots is another example. This is a discrete log function. So you fix some large prime P and the generator A of the multiplicative group mod P. And G inverse of X is just exponentiating A to the power X modulo P. That's very easy to do using repeated squaring. And the inverse, which is G, the hard part, the hard direction, is taking the logarithm base A of X in this field. And the best algorithm that exists today for this function g is something like exponential in root n. So it seems like it's an extremely hard function. Okay, so how can you build a generator from such a function? Well, what Shamir suggested was to, just iterate g. Okay, so you take a random seed of length m and you compute g of s, g of g of s, G of G of G. Let's say you need n blocks, you can compute n blocks like this. This will be your n blocks, and that's your generator, and that should be hard to predict. And I guess nobody has a complaint at this point. In the previous examples I showed you, this iterated function G was easy to compute, right? But how would you do that? I mean, how would you compute the blocks here? Sort of goes against the notion of generator. Anybody has an idea? Why did we pick a one-way function? What? Very good. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you know you need n blocks, this is a permutation after all, so you can start at the right. Of course, you are not telling your opponent, but, you know, it's very easy to compute all these n blocks. You start at the right and apply G inverse n times. And then you have all these values, you start broadcasting them from the left. So the first observation is that it is easy to actually generate, like what we would like of a generator. The second observation is the one that's hard to predict. So why is it hard to predict? In fact, the proof is one line, and it's here. Of course, it's based on the hardness of G. So suppose some, efficient procedure T was trying to predict. What does it mean, predict? Was trying to take the first I blocks and get the I plus first block. Well, the probability of success here is exactly of the probability of success of another procedure, T prime, that takes just the ith block and generates the I plus first. Why? For the same reason. It can generate by itself. It's easy. The I minus one, etc., all the way back. So those two are more or less equivalent. But what is this? I mean, what is this probability? That's exactly the probability that, you know, this algorithm on a random X computes G of X. And that's the thing we know is hard. So if G is hard and it's one way, the universe is easy, we have here a generator that passes all predictability tests. So that's great. And it's certainly useful. However, he pointed out, Shamir in his paper, that it still leaves a lot to be desired if you really want, you know, sort of pseudo, something that's pseudo-random output. And the nature of the problem here comes from the fact that you are generating blocks. So saying that you cannot predict an M, let's say M is 100 bits, the fact that you cannot, you know, the probability of getting these 100 bits is extremely tiny, is one in a zillion, you know, still doesn't mean that you cannot tell what the first 10 or 50 bits even with absolute certainty, right? And that you would not like, that you would not call pseudo-random. So the problem is that even though the whole block is, you know, you have no chance of guessing what it will be, you can guess a lot, you know, some significant parts of it. And in fact, for this particular generator, it's easy to see that you can always get the least significant bit, because that's just a quadratic character, and that's easy to compute. Anyway, so that was his point, and that was his challenge, you know, what can you do further? I mean, can you get a really unpredictable generator? And that came in this seminal paper of Blum and Michali in 81, a year later. And, you know, in these three lines there are lots of ideas, so I'll try to tell you. Their main idea was the following. Why send all the M bits each time? Send just one bit of the block. The question was, which bit? Well, for the discrete log function, they suggested the most significant bit. And not only did they suggest it, so this is what I call here H of the block, H of this block. So just a one-bit part of the, you know, function of these M bits. In the case of discrete log, they chose the most significant bit. And whenever you choose, so this is supposed to be the hard core, the really hard part of these M bits, what encapsulates the hardness of computing G. And it turns out that for discrete log, the most significant bit, what you can prove is that if discrete log is hard, then this particular bit, any algorithm attempting to compute it, which is efficient, will have basically 50-50 chance of guessing it. If it had better chances, you could compute discrete log efficiently. So they had a reduction from predicting better than a coin toss this particular bit of the discrete logarithm to computing the whole discrete logarithm. So this is about a half. Now, because it's about a half and you are generating one bit at a time, that's exactly what you want, right? You want, if you saw the first I bits, you have 50-50 chance roughly of guessing the next bit. So that's perfectly fine. And in fact, followed from this is that under this assumption that discrete log is hard, you know, you have a what he called cryptographically secure generator. So this was the first, you know, major progress, and it's the first place where you see that, I mean, somehow you can take something difficult and make from it, or you can take a lower bound and you can make an upper bound out of it. It's a very, you know, I think a very unique phenomenon. We are used to it already, but those of you who didn't see it, I think it should be pretty surprising. So the next thing, what's the next idea on the stack? So we are here, you know, we look at this generator and we know that it's unpredictable. So if we look at it from the left, each bit we see is like a coin toss, even though it's deterministically generated. What happens, I mean, is it pseudo-random? Suppose we look at it from the right. What would you think? I mean, certainly if you look at this sequence from the right, we know more or less by definition that it's easy to predict. Right. What about this sequence? Any guesses? It's not costing any money, you know. So suppose we are trying to guess, we are given these just more significant bits of these blocks, but in the going from right to left. You know, we are given all of them but T1, the first one. Well, you are not an adventurous crowd, I guess. Okay. Well, the answer is you can't. And not only can't you predict it from the right, you cannot predict it from any direction. In fact, it's pseudo-random. It doesn't matter, you know, you get all of them at once, and I ask you whether they are random, you know, this is a random sequence or it's coming from this pseudo-random generator. You cannot tell. So it's random in the sense that we wanted it in the first definition. So this is Andy Yao's paper from 82, that has lots of important ideas, but that's one of them. Namely that prediction tests are universal. So what does this theorem say? It says that if you want a pseudo-random generator, it's sufficient that you design it to pass all prediction tests. If it does, it passes every test. There's no way to distinguish it from random. And again, like the previous ideas I showed you, it's really simple. So here's a one slide proof. Okay, so what's the idea? The idea is the following. Suppose you had any method of, you know, telling this distribution from random. So here I have two pictures. One of them, so you have this test, which I draw here as a triangle, which means some Boolean circuit, some computation. Just think of C as some computation, some algorithm. Here this algorithm takes n totally random bits, b1 through bn, it's the uniform distribution, and here it takes g of u sub n, so this generator applied to a small seed of length n. And it is trying to distinguish, let's say it can distinguish between them, so let's say the probability it outputs 1 on the left is different by epsilon, something non-negligible from what it does on the right. Okay? So we have some tests that distinguish the random from pseudo-random, and now what I need to show you is that if such a thing exists, actually a prediction test exists. There is a way to predict this generator from the left. Okay? What's the idea? The idea is, I don't know what to call it, continuity argument or hybrid argument or, you know. It's the following idea. It actually was used, probably was used all over the place, but in this set, in this kind of setting by Goldwasser and Micali in 81. You think of this distribution, call it D sub 0, and call the last one D sub n, and you build n distributions in the middle in the following way. D sub I is the distribution which takes the first I bits from the left and the right n minus I from here. Okay, so it sort of interpolates between these two distributions. Of course, it's all of these distributions are well defined, and we can now ask the question: What happens if we feed any of one of these distributions to our test? Okay, and let's say p sub I is the probability that it says 1. But we know that the difference between p 0 and p n is epsilon. So the difference between, at least for some I, the difference there must be at least, you know, a step of epsilon over n, right? That's a continuity, if you want. I mean, there's no continuity here. I don't know what to call it. There is some I for which pi minus p sub I minus plus 1 is at least epsilon n, and if epsilon was non-negligible also, epsilon over n is non-negligible. Non-negligible, I mean something that's, let's say, 1 over polynomial, something that if you repeat, you know, a few times, you'll notice. Okay, good. So we have this. So now let's build the prediction, the predictor, I guess. And the idea is extremely simple. So let's look at these two distributions, di and di plus 1. They differ only in one position. Okay, to the left of it, it's all pseudo-random bits. To the right of it, it's all purely, you know, good coin tosses. And here it's either a pseudo-random bit or a random bit. And, well, I said the bits to the right were random bits, so we can just fix them randomly to some value. Obviously, by averaging, this gap of epsilon over n will remain. So we can get rid of them. And now we have some other computation, C prime, that distinguishes just these two situations. The first are pseudo-random bits, and the last bit is either random or pseudo-random. It's either ri plus 1, which we are trying to predict, or it's some coin toss. But obviously, if it behaves differently in these two situations, it has some correlation with the last bit. Well, then it's really an easy exercise to convert it into a circuit that just looks at the first I bits and guesses with the same advantage, epsilon over n, what I plus 1 would be. So that's a conversion from a general test to a prediction test. And from it followed lots of things. Yao generalized the Blum-Mikali result to any one-way function, and if any one-way function exists, then RP has sub-exponential simulations, and there are lots of other results. Maybe I will not get into them. So let me sort of summarize what is where we are standing. So this is the Blum-Mikali Yao generator, what it does. So this generator starts from some function, this one-way function. So this is the hard notion. That's when we say in a natural hard problem, we mean in this case a one-way function. So it's a problem that you need somehow both easiness and hardness properties of it, and that's a one-wayness here. So the easiness means that the inverse is easy, it's in P. The hardness means that basically you have some lower bound, so no circuit of some polynomial size, sufficient to choose these parameters, can compute the function G on a random input with probability better than 1 over n squared or something. If you have such a function, and for all we know, and for all the world trade and banks and everybody believe in, the factoring is such a function. On the other examples I showed you, under this assumption, we can build a pseudo-random generator, namely a function taking m bits to n bits. It generates its output in polynomial time, but it's pseudo-random. So pseudo-random means, again, that every circuit trying to differentiate between its output and truly random coin tosses will not make a significant distinction. Certainly it will be less than one-tenth or even less than 1/n. And now if you just, it depends exactly, how hard you believe this function is. If you just say it's not in polynomial size, then you get immediately the sub-exponential simulation I showed you. If you assume, and that's, again, for all we know, is a property of factoring and discrete log, etc., and an exponential 2 to the n to the epsilon lower bound, then this m can actually get to be much smaller. It can get to be some like polylog. And then the simulation of RP will be very close to polynomial time. It will be some like 2 to the, n to the log n or something like this. So randomness is almost useless. So at this point, the only thing, well, I really dislike this. What do I do? How to progress from here. The main question is, what do we do if there are no one-way functions? Okay, we understand that if one-way functions exist, then randomness is not useful. But I promised you much more than that, at least in the first slide. Suppose one-way functions, they are all easy. Which is, And anyway, we have just three examples. Can't we get similar results on assuming P is different than NP, or even weaker assumptions? And the answer is yes, and that's sort of this alternative generator that I'll just describe to you, and probably tomorrow I'll talk some more about its properties and how it leads to some, further nice results, like RP equals P in some cases, under strong assumptions. But this generator that Noam Nissan I introduced, what it uses, the hardness it uses is much, much weaker than the hardness, you know. So the assumption here is much weaker, and I'll show you, you get basically the same consequence. So here you just need any Boolean function in exponential time. And since it's Boolean, of course, you can compute it with probability half. You say, you know, you toss a coin, or you say, you know, what is most popular, more popular, one or zero. So all you can hope for is this kind of thing, namely that no circuit, no small circuit, can compute it with probability significantly different than a half, bigger than a half. And under this assumption, you get basically the same consequence. You get a pseudo-random generator. The thing you lose, which is really important to have in some applications, the efficient generation of the output of the generator, is lost here in some sense. So the generator is not in polynomial time anymore. The time to compute it is exponential in the seed length. So you lose that. However, for the purposes of de-randomization of this deterministic simulation I showed you, who cares? I mean, you are anyway investing 2 to the m time just to go over all possible seeds, so you might as well allow 2 to the m time for, you know, each application of G. And this observation is really what allows this to work. Okay, so maybe I'll just... I'll keep the definition to this the definition of the generator for tomorrow. And rather than show it now, what I'll do, I'll just tell you. I mean, because I still didn't keep my promise, and I still didn't show you how to get from a half function in the sense we understand it to a pseudo-random generator. So this is, in the assumption here, what I said is that no small circuit can compute this function with probability much better than a half. Here it is. This half. So when we talk about something like computing satisfiability or something, we don't really mean, when we say it's hard, we don't mean that it's hard to maybe we can get it right 3/4 of the time, but what we mean hard usually is that, you know, we just cannot do it, you know, in the worst case. So the question is how to start from something which is hard, namely something which simply cannot compute on every input, and build from it another function which is so very hard it's totally unpredictable. And I'll just tell you the ideas that go into that. And this part of the story is a story of how to amplify hardness, how to amplify computational hardness. So, oops, that's probably, wow, amazing. Fits. Okay, so the starting point, I mean, the honest-to-God assumption we would like to assume is that we have just some hard function, some function h. I mean, it will be for us in exponential time, like the permanent function or something like that, or satisfiability, that is hard for every small circuit. So every small circuit that takes a random input from, I mean, that, you know, is trying to do this, just going to fail. So what does it mean going to fail? At least for some input, it will give a wrong answer. So in other words, for a uniform distribution on all instances, it will just, the probability of success will be less than 1. Maybe it's exponentially close to 1, but it's still not 1. That's the situation which we call a hard function. We always look at worst case analysis. So some instance is hard for every circuit. There is some instance which make it wrong. And what we would like to get to is this situation. We want to get to a function which the probability of guessing it correctly is not better than, you know, just tossing a coin. How do you get from between these two? So the idea is that you go through an intermediate stage, which is generating some function f So this is worst case hardness. What you first try to do is get some average case hardness. So you are trying to build from F a function that is hard on average, namely, if you pick a random instance, you cannot, you know, maybe you can do it with probability 3/4 or maybe 0.99, but not much more than that. Okay. And then from it, you build the next step. And the techniques used for these two stages are totally different. And I'll just tell you what, briefly what they are. For this stage, this is what's called random self-reducibility. And here the idea is to take a Boolean function and make it into a polynomial, extend it to be a function over some finite field, and then use this sort of error correction properties of functions, of low degree functions over finite fields. And I'll just mention that this idea is one of the most influential ideas in the last 10 years of, I mean, the fruits of this idea in theoretical computer science and algorithms is amazing. This is, at least for people that know about various interactive proofs like IP, the results like IP equals P-space, the notion of holographic proof or probabilistically checkable proof that, well, I'm sure, well, it's a great topic for another lecture series. All these heavily depend on this idea of an arithmetization of a Boolean function. And once you do this kind of thing, you can make worst-case hardness into average-case hardness. The second part is taking something that's already, you know, maybe 0.99 hard and amplifying this. And this is, in fact, that's what's called the Yao's exclusive OR lemma. And the idea here, I have a picture, I think. It will be my last slide if you lose your patience. And so Nick gave me an hour and a half, but I don't think I'll exhaust you this much. So the idea is we have the situation that something is, you know, cannot be predicted with probability better than 0.9 or something. And we want to get from it something that cannot be predicted much better than a half. And if you think of the information theoretic analog of this, is you can think of the following. You have a biased coin, okay, which, I mean, this depicts a biased coin, okay. This is, you know, if you suppose you flip heads or tails just by throwing a die, and if it's 1 through 5, you call it heads, and otherwise you call it tails. So if I do this and I ask you to guess what would the outcome be, you can do it with probability 0.5, I mean with probability 5/6, but not better, right? So the question is how to take this die and build from it, I mean from this experiment, build something, I mean you can think of it just as a 5/6 biased coin. How to build from it an almost unbiased coin? And at least in the information theoretic scenario, like we are talking about here, the idea is very simple. You just do this experiment many, many times and ask your opponent to guess the parity of the number of heads, whether the number of heads will be even or odd. And it's not hard to see, and in fact I'll show you, that it converges very rapidly to a half. You know, so it converges exponentially rapidly. If this was 1 minus delta, here you get 1 minus 2 delta to the k if you repeat it k times. Which will be your target, something half plus epsilon. So for this, you know, the number of experiments is this, some like log 1 over epsilon over delta. And the way to see this exponential convergence is here. So this coin toss of 1 minus delta heads and delta tails can be viewed differently. I mean, we can do it by flipping two coins in the following way. We can first flip a coin which is heads with probability 1 minus 2 delta, and with probability 2 delta it tells us to flip another coin which is unbiased, half-half, okay, and then we get heads or tails. So if you look at these two experiments, even though they are different, their outcome has the same, you know, the probability of heads and tails have exactly the same probability. But looking at it this way is sort of convenient, because what does it say? I mean, when can you predict the parity of a sequence of bits? I mean, if one of them is an unbiased coin toss, then you have no chance, right? But looking at this little tree, you see that if any time you take this branch, if any time you take this branch, you get to a biased coin, to an unbiased coin toss. Okay, so the only way in which you can do anything, get an advantage over a half, is if you land all these k times in this branch, which with probability 1 minus 2 delta. So anyway, that's the reason it works here. Yao's exclusive OR lemma is a computational analog of this information theoretic experiment. It says that if, you know, this really does not mean your probability of success in this information theoretic game, but it's actually the best you can do given some computational limitations. Then when you repeat and take parity, then given similar computational limitations, you cannot do better than that. And actually that will be the main thing I'll talk about tomorrow, this exclusive OR lemma and even how to de-randomize. And that's basically the end. What I want to it's sort of strange to put open problem session questions in a survey talk, but I mentioned that complexity theory is quite ignorant as to its two major open questions. Are there natural hard problems, and does randomness help? And you know, this particular question: does RP different than is RP different than exponential time? Can randomness bias everything it can possibly get? Sort of captures both of them. I mean, so you know, I think that. Unlike the P versus NP question, for which we understand today why we are stuck at a certain point, at least we have some understanding, some excuses why we didn't solve it yet. This problem, I don't think we have such excuses, so I think mainly, at least at this point, there was not enough work devoted to it. So, you know, I think that, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be solved. I think that the only thing that makes it harder for me to think about it today than it was 6 months ago is this recent result I mentioned, was that in the beginning, is that if you can prove this, then it actually will imply that a very, very efficient sub-exponential simulation of RP, and somehow because it implies this, you know, it seems maybe the only only way to do it is via de-randomization. Initially, you know. Well, anyway, it will imply de-randomization, so anyway, it makes it somewhat somewhat harder. But, okay, that's I leave you with that. Questions? I take questions. I'm allowed to take questions. Yeah. Great. Any questions? Why is everybody looking?
Questions from Alberta or other sites?
Well, you should set an example to the other sites by.
Oh my. No questions here.
We gave up.
We don't appear to have any questions at SFU either.
Yeah. Next time I'll try to to do it better.
No failing questions, how about a fly?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just don't entirely feel for myself, but I understood what you were saying.
Yeah, I think it can be understood by everyone. That's the beauty of it. Yeah. So well, what are you doing?
Epidemiology.
Uh-huh. Oh, great. I didn't expect this to be so far. Yeah, okay, that's wonderful.
I have a mathematical.
I assume you would
Otherwise
start, yeah. Yeah, if you didn't have any automatical, I would be stunned.
The reason I'm interested is I'm interested in computing the solutions to predicting, well, using Markov models, and exactly calculating the distribution of the results, as opposed to just doing simulations to calculate the results.
I see you have some hidden Markov model which you are trying to learn.
Yes.
In some.
So I pick up some ideas.
I'm not sure this is. Actually, so if I mean, since you came, since you told me this, what I think is the relevant field within theoretical computer science that will be, may help you, where you can pick up some ideas, is the computational learning.